Alan Kring Productions in association with Emergent Light Studio presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 25, delivered on November 19th.
Tonight, free cash flow. Before we begin the topic of the evening, a quick look at the markets. And let's start off. Sir, good day or bad day? No, you. Yeah. So-so. I guess that's kind of a mixed reaction. The markets were mixed today. You had the S&P 500, which finished just a little tiny bit down. The Dow was down a little bit more significantly. But then you had the NASDAQ, which had a somewhat good day. You notice that all of the markets had a tail off at the end. You see that, for example, the S&P 500 index slid off on a sell surge. The bears had a little bit of fun there at the end. And similarly, you can see that with the other markets too. The Dow had a drop, and then the NASDAQ did as well as the Russell 2000. Moving on, gold was the beneficiary of some of the drain of funds from the equities market, as was silver. But having a quick look here, the 10-year bond eased back on price. Price goes down, yields go up. In other words, this index indicates that there is a general movement upward, which we've been seeing more days than not over the past week or so, of interest rates rising. Interest rates rising means that the economy could slow down. Another indication that there is some reason to believe that we are still on track for a recession down the line. Similarly, you can see that the volume on the S&P 500 index was about half of what it normally would be over the past 52 weeks. So there's that eerie quiet before the storm that we've been seeing before. On to the topic of tonight's lecture, though. The topic at hand, and I've brought this up repeatedly in the course, is free cash flow. Now, this is our go-to in finance, as opposed in accounting to profit being the big the big thing. Free cash flow is how much money is available at the end of our cycle, our business cycle from period to period. Now, we can do free cash flow projections on a weekly, monthly, quarterly, semi-annual basis. Traditionally, we teach it on an annual basis, and most companies more or less focus on the annual free cash flow estimations. We are after the more or less the year-to-year performance of projects. Now, in this lecture, I want to point out that what we're really looking at, we're looking at whether to say yes or no to a project. It will boil down to the net present value of future expected free cash flows. And also, we are interested in incremental free cash flow. That means we take the value of the company with the project minus the value of the company. Actually, the value of the company's free cash flows without the project. How much extra does it add to the free cash flows of the company as a present value, as a net present value? Does it help? Well, then good. Does it hurt? Well, then bad. Now, this entails that we have to pay attention not just to the project itself and what it's generating in terms of revenues and in terms of incurrence of costs, but we also have to look at the possibilities that this project and the company's overall revenue and cost basis have some connection to them. You can't take this too far, but I've pointed this out before and I'll say it again here. On the downside is cannibalization. In other words, we can very well look at the revenues from a project, but if those revenues actually impact negatively on the revenue from other projects, then we have to pay attention to that and say, okay, this drained a certain number of dollars from our existing products. Therefore, that is a negative revenue on the new project. We have to take that into account. On the other hand, you can also have synergies where one project actually benefits the larger company's products in some material, measurable, in other words, liquidatable, in other words, we can make money, dollar analysis of it, way. This is overused. Sometimes we will imagine, well, this product is going to help all of our products. You've got to show that that's really going to happen. And it really does happen, though, in some cases. Good example is actually right now there is a makeup line, CoverGirl, that has been around for decades, and it's solid, but the problem is that its revenues were not keeping up with the times because a lot of younger people see it as something that is, you know, my mom's, my grandma's makeup. CoverGirl did something quite dramatic. On YouTube, and I don't know if you have seen the very, very popular YouTube channels, but CoverGirl picked up as one of its representatives a YouTuber and male model who now does YouTubes with a female model. They just do on the YouTube, they just put on CoverGirl makeups. They do all kinds of different things, fascinating. And the male model has developed a huge cult following, and that has benefited the entire CoverGirl line just from the introduction of the project of investing in this YouTube channel and this model who is he's just excellent online. He's got a very, very smooth, cool style. So it's added to the whole line of CoverGirl. Even the makeups that they don't show on the YouTube channel that are CoverGirl benefit from it because now younger females and males are going toward those. CoverGirl, because it's no longer mom's and grandma's makeup. It's our makeup. So that can actually occur in this kind of thing. I want to distinguish two kinds of projects that can be taken on. One are the new projects. The other are replacement projects. They are actually very different in how you think about them from the revenue on down. Now, a new project is going to be, of course, subject to things like cannibalization and synergy. It's going to have its own revenue stream. We're selling some of this. We sold at $10 a unit, we sold 5,000 of them, so we made $50,000 on this new project in our first year, or second year, whatever. Not so bad. It's just that's how you do it. However, a replacement project is a different animal. Suppose, for example, you had a trucking fleet, and the fleet, your trucks, cost fuel and maintenance on a monthly basis $50,000. Okay, now we could replace those with a fleet that runs fuel and maintenance $45,000 a per week or whatever, or per month. Okay, then the incremental cash flow from the replacement project is positive $5,000. It's not bringing in any revenue of its own. What it's doing is lowering your costs. That is freeing up, as in free cash flow. So it's not always just money coming in, extra money coming in. It's not as much money going out. So that replacement project would have on its revenue line, revenue quote unquote, a $5,000 positive because it is saving the company that much money. You could also include it somewhere else, but that's how we think about replacement projects. This gets to be a pretty difficult, kind of a complicated thing sometimes too. Because you have to say, all right, when is replacement going to be appropriate? And a lot of business entities don't think in terms of the cost savings. All they think about is, oh God, this is going to cost us so much to replace this. I'll give you a real example right here at ISU. I've told you before, I teach for Management Development International. It's through international studies. Now, International Studies used to be housed over in Fell Hall. Now they've moved it to Williams, but they're in Fell Hall. I go in the first time I taught it, some time long ago, and I looked around and I was looking for, I want to take these international people and take them into the computer room and show them some Excel and some mad skills for doing finance on Excel, not knowing whether they'd actually used Excel or not. And I was kind of looking around, so I asked this receptionist, and she said, oh, it's down at the end of the hall, down there, turn to the right, and you'll see it. And so I went down there, and I looked in this room, and what I saw were 15, I believe it was, Dell computers, circa 1911, I think it was? 2011, I'm sorry. They had on them Windows 7, to give you an idea of how old these computers were. I mean, these were computers where you might want to look on the side to see if there's a hand crank to make them go. They were seriously outdated. And I kind of fussed and bitched about this to the director, and he said, well, it's going to cost us so much to replace these. Okay, yes, you're going to have to put in modern computers, and you're going to have to, state of the art, where we are now, and we're going to have to put new software on them that is, you know, something past pixelated stuff. Well, that's great, but that's just in their minds, that's just a cost. Okay, you're not considering, first of all, that those computers are not energy efficient. They do not have the minimal energy usage that modern computers, the much more modern computers have. The monitors certainly are going to be hotter and use more energy. That's going to be right there. But also there were the opportunity costs. These computers are vulnerable as heck to exploits. That's Windows 7. It's not that, and there was even a deeper issue involved. And I still haven't quite gotten past through that. when you're talking with people who are not finance people, sometimes it's very difficult. But let me do it this way. Okay. Sir, you are thinking about your going to college, and you're looking at different universities, and you've decided on two of them. You go to one, and it's just this gorgeous, modern facility. The student center is all nice and pretty and laid out in curves and open areas and dining halls and everything. You go to the computer lab and there's state of the art and everything is just top notch. Then you go to this other college where it looks like you're stepping back to the 1950s. They have old professors like me. Yeah. We've got an abacus over there you can use. If you're lazy, go ahead, use it. And you go to the student union, and the student union is a shack. And they've got a foosball table in there to entertain the students. And they also have something like sort of a cafeteria, but it reminds you suspiciously of your grandma's kitchen. So which one are you going to go to? Yeah. Hence why we spent all that ridiculous amount of money to upgrade the Bone Student Center, why we spent all of that money in the dorms on, you go to that lower level, they have that one where it's like you go to different stations and get different food. I mean, it's just wonderful. I mean, I was a dorm daddy over there, and I went downstairs, and I'm thinking, you know, I kind of like this. I didn't want to go back to my own flat. Well, my cats were there. I thought I'd take them over, and we could eat there. But you understand that there's that ridiculous cost. We are in a competition from hell at the top-notch universities anymore. Literally, make the dorms as close to five-star hotels as we can, make the eating facilities really great, make all of their accommodations, the student center, the computers, everything as modern as we can. It costs us a fortune. But at the same time, we would lose to the schools that did do all of this stuff if we didn't do the same thing. It's a rough competition, and it's expensive as hell, but literally the incremental cash flows we look at from, say, rehabbing the Bone Student Center, it's not just that upfront cost, but it's the revenues that we are getting that we would lose if we didn't do it. That's opportunity cost, and that is one of the most important parts of free cash flow analysis that oftentimes is not included. It's not what it costs us to do something. It's not the money out of our pockets. It's the money that does not come into our pockets, which is sometimes more difficult to measure. But we try very hard to get a handle on, okay, what do we lose if we don't do this for our students to make it better for them here? Always remember when you're doing free cash flow analysis, and many of you will be corporate animals in your professional lives, and you will be involved in doing parts of this. It's very different for us from what it is for accounting, where everything comes in receipts and sales figures and checks written and all that. We have to go a lot beyond that to get to where we want to be in our work. I'm going to introduce you here to a term that I don't think is in your textbook. It's certainly used in the next textbook level up in 341, but I like it here because it allows us to move forward without sweating a lot of things out. First things first, we are going to get the earnings before interest and taxes. And then that's pre-tax. In other words, our pre-tax operating income. So let me put that up here. Pre-tax operating income. And then we're going to multiply that by 1 minus the corporate marginal tax rate, 1 minus T. So that will give us this. will give us
afterwards the net operating income. But we have to remember that we have to add back those non-cash items, depreciation and amortization, because those didn't really happen. We have to recognize and allow them in EBIT because they represent tax shields. But once we have recognized that, then we have to add the original depreciation and amortization back because it really didn't happen as cash. This animal right here, we call NOPAT, net operating profit after taxes. NOPAT. Now, as I go on here, and these are just simple little formulas, you apply them. In a lecture like this, I'm just trying to make sense of them. If it doesn't make sense, just put them in the formula and don't think about it. Okay, so we got the NOPAT. From this, we have our reservoir of money for paying for other things that are not operating matters. From this cash flow NOPAT, and it's a preliminary cash flow, we will be able to pay our interest expense . We will be able to pay dividends and stock repurchases if we want to. And then after that, whatever is left, we will pay for our capital expenditures. This is what I was calling that money that is available for internally generated equity. That's what I was calling it. So in other words, before we would go and sell new stock, this would be shareholders' money that we could use to finance projects. We would mix it with debt so that we maintained our optimal capital structure. So for example, suppose that the debt and the equity numbers, the optimal capital structure of a company is 25% debt, 75% equity. Okay. Let's say that the internally generated this number right here was $250,000 was available. That's available. That we wouldn't have to go sell new stock. This is shareholders' money that we have brought down past the bottom line. We've brought this down all the way down. It belongs to the shareholders. Now we can plow it back in. We've given the shareholders some candy with dividends. We've done some stock repurchases. We've paid our bondholders to shut them up for the period and all of that. And this is now available for us to enhance shareholder value, this $250,000. Okay, so that would mean that if we want to maintain our optimal capital structure, this $250,000 would be 75% of capital expenditures, which means that our capital expenditures, if you divided both sides by the 0.75, would be $333,333. That is how much we could spend on new projects. We'd spend $250,000 with this internally generated cash and mix that with $83,000 of debt
and we would never have to go sell more. We wouldn't have to go out and sell new stock, which is very expensive as far as component cost of capital goes, remember. This is what we could do just with our current capital structure and the money we had earned through operations. You could almost think of this as our projects financed internally. You could think of it that way. And companies really do it this way. Then we can go and look at our projects and figure out what we're going to do and all that kind of stuff. But there's a problem here. Remember that we are going to project free cash flows. Let's say, year 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, year 0, we spend $50,000 on a project. Year 1, it begins to take off with $10,000 in sales. And then year 2, we have $15,000. We come up to about, let's say, $30,000. And then the project begins to fizzle out here at the end with maybe $8,000. And then in year 5, it's closing up shop and we have, let's say, $2,000 plus salvage. And I'll talk about that in a minute here. Okay, we just take the net present value of those cash flows and we're all done. That's how it is. I showed you net present value last week. This is how, if this number, the net present value of that stuff right there, is positive, we say yes to the project. If it's negative, we say no to the project. Wonderful. Now, of course, we have to worry about our discount rate. And that, before I say anything more about that, that takes us over here. What we can do with NOPAT. I've almost forgot something else. We also have to worry about changes in net operating working capital. In other words, we're going to have to build inventory, things like that, sell off inventory. Oh. I almost forgot that. Okay, here we go. Going back over here, you see this interest expense, dividends, and stock repurchases? We do not consider those in free cash flow. And the first reaction, if you're thinking about it, would say, now, wait a minute, fat boy, that is actually money out of the company's pocket, isn't it? Yeah, but if I'm using the right discount rate, that those costs would already be in that discount rate. They'd have to be. I mean, especially, a lot of companies, for the discount rate, they use the weighted average cost of capital, WACC. They should probably use something larger than that, representing more risk. But certainly, if your baseline is the weighted average cost of capital for a discount rate for those future expected cash flows, that would already include the component cost of capital. I mean, your interest expense, that's your cost, after-tax cost of debt. Your dividends, that's how we find the cost of equity. Your dividends and your stock repurchases, that's how we find the cost of equity, is D1 over R minus G, D1 over P0 plus G. Those are already embedded. If you're using the right discount rate to find your net present value, you have already included interest expense, dividends, and stock repurchases. Their cost is in the discount rate that you use. So that's why the free cash flow analysis won't include those things in it at all. So we get down here to the actual free cash flow. Free cash flow is going to be NOPAT minus your capital expenditures
minus the quantity, capital expenditures, plus the changes in net operating working capital. That is free cash flow. It doesn't have interest expense, dividends, or stock repurchases in it. It just doesn't. Because those are included when we do the discount back to find the NPV. So if we did both, we included those and also had it in our discount rate, we would be double counting a certain number of costs. It takes a while. Maybe it's obvious to you, but it took me a while to buy into that. And finally, I got it. It was a couple of years before I finally understood it. But anyway, there's your free cash flow right there from a project. That's an incremental free cash flow, I should point out, of course. It's incremental. You get to there, and you're in good shape. Now, let me talk about net operating working capital for just a minute. And I'm going to use a monthly example. Madam, are you in the holiday spirit yet?
Yeah.
Jingle bells, jingle bell?
Yeah.
I'm not.
Oh.
I'll work on it. I'll get there.
Okay.
December 26th.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. But when you're in business, you need to get into the Christmas mood by no later than September. Okay? And you hear these people just have a hissy fit. I'm hearing Christmas music and it's not even Thanksgiving. Well, yeah. Welcome to American capitalism. We got to do that. We got to get you in the mood early. Are you in the mood now? Well, you should be if you're going to be a good American consumer. You need to be buying right now. And in that regard, we need to, as business people, as all of you are, you're going to be business professionals, you need to embrace that early holiday season because you yourself are preparing for the holiday season. If you're preparing for it in October, you are too late. So let me explain why I'm ranting like this about it. And no, I don't like hearing jingle bells while I walk into the stupid store right now. And walking past that incessant ding, 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 ding bell, and that woman outside of Walmart, she puts it right in my face. Ding, 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 ding. Because she knows it irritates me. And I told her I'd give her $5 if she stopped, and she said, deal. And I put it in there. So you know what she did? She waited until I came back out, and then she ding, ding, ding in my face going out. Anyway, October, November, December, January. Now, what we're going to do, if you want to be ready for the holiday season, you need to ramp up your inventory. You have a normal level of inventory. In October, you're going to pour money in to raise that level of inventory. Let's say in October you spend an extra incremental $10,000 on inventory. Now, this is going to be simplistic, of course. Realistically, it would be more variable than this. But now, okay, you sell that inventory in October, so you build it back up in November. That means that the change in inventory is no longer 10,000, it's zero. Because you deplete that 10,000, you sell it, then you bring 10,000 back in. So it's a wash in November. The same in November, you'll sell the extra 10,000, then you'll build it back up, so there's no net change in December. And then, thank God, it's over. Christmas is over. You can stop lying about being a happy person. And so we sell off that last 10,000 from December, and we don't replace it, so a free cash flow returns positive $10,000. because you sold it and you didn't buy more. Okay? Well, you're saying, well, isn't this, why are you doing this? Isn't this kind of like a wash? No, because the present value of the $10,000 at the end wouldn't be as much as the present value right now of the $10,000 you're blowing out. So it's not, you can't just say, well, let's, it goes down and then it goes back up. Not quite, because of this, the time value of money makes the recovery have less value than the original. That's why you don't want to start too soon to build your inventory. Like, I wouldn't be doing it in September or August, because then, you know, if I spent the $10,000 in, let's say, August, when I recovered it, that would be like almost 5 months later. So I would have a lesser value of the recovery as a present value. So there's kind of an optimal thing. You have to decide when you're going to start building the inventory. It would typically be in October, and it is for me because of the Christmas season. I'm building $4,000, I'm thinking, and I actually started that like last month in October, and I'm finishing it up this month. But then it will be a wash through as I replace and put it back in. The danger for me is that by the time I get to January, I might not be able to sell it for $10,000. And there's a problem too. If it's seasonal, you want to get as much of that stuff off your shelves sold so that you're not having to sell it at sale, fire sale prices. You're going to do it. I make calendars. And of course, once I'm getting to January, I have to sell them at heavy discounts to get rid of all of my inventory. But one way or the other, you know, that's neither here nor there. But do understand that this might look a little mysterious at first, the change in inventory, the change in net operating working capital. Might look a little bit odd at first, but it's just because you spend money to build it, and then the month after that, you sell it off and then replenish it, so there's no net change in that month. The same thing in December. You sell off what you got in November, the extra you got in November, then you build it back up for the December sales. And then finally, once December's over, you can just simply sell it off and go back to your original inventory levels. It's a little complicated to think about it first, but after a while it begins to make sense. Honestly, it was when I started doing this in real life that it actually, oh, I get it now. I'm not really spending any more money in November and December. I'm not actually having extra money coming out. I'm just getting money coming in, and then I spend that to buy back the inventory, the up higher inventory level. Okay, enough of that. That gives you the idea of generally what's happening with the change in net operating working capital. A lot of that is driven by inventory. However, it can also be accounts receivable. I will allow it's just the way it is. Because I sell on credit, my receivables will tend to go up starting in November. They'll surge upwards somewhat. And that means that there's revenue that didn't turn into cash. So that increase in my receivables is actually a negative cash flow. Because I'm saying I got this money. The IRS requires that I say I got this money, but I didn't really get it. So once I've gotten past the NOPAT, I can say, okay, that didn't really happen. So I've got to subtract out that increase in receivables. And then that receivables, some people pay off, but others come in. So the receivables doesn't change from that higher level for a few months. As a matter of fact, with 6 months financing, I don't recover to my original level of receivables until maybe like May. So what you would see is the receivables would go up for a couple of months, and then they would level off at that higher level. And then as people started paying off, they would go down. So initially, I would have a negative change in net operating working capital as people bought on credit. and then later that would sag back down, that my receivables would, and that would represent a positive change in net operating working capital. It can be a little complicated there, but don't sweat it. This is 240, so I wouldn't throw a really complicated problem at you. Salvage. Salvage, we have to deal with a couple of things in the salvage value. The salvage value that we need to consider, and I'm going to put here, this is not just salvage value, this is after-tax salvage value. So here's the thing. After-tax salvage value is going to be what's your salvage value, but the problem is that you've been accounting, bringing down by depreciation your book value. Now, if that salvage value is higher than what the book value is at the end of the project, you have to pay tax on it. So in other words, if you've been you bought something for, let's say, well, no, let me give you kind of a real example. With the projects I used to do, low-income housing for the elderly, I mean, the depreciation on those was 20 years. That was what we had to do, 20 years. But these weren't going to last more than 10 years. They were nice, but they just weren't built for the long term. So we would essentially close the projects out at year 10, move the people to new places. But you would still have, like, for one, let's say, $2.5 million. After 10 years, there was still maybe about $600,000 of net fixed assets on the book. So if we sold it for $800,000, the project, that means that the book value, we were exceeding the book value by $200,000, and so we had to pay tax on how much we got for the property minus how much we said the property was worth on the financial statements. What we said on the financial statements it was worth, we were made to by the rules of depreciation. So essentially, if you sell something for more than the remaining book value of it, you end up in a situation where you pay tax on it. And so the salvage minus the book is essentially how much accumulated depreciation. So the book value would be the initial cost, which we wrote on the books, minus how much accumulated depreciation had been recognized. Now, this is getting me into the world of accounting, and I am actually working real hard to get through this as fast as I can because accounting makes me sad. But you understand that when we built it, $2.5 million, okay, over 10 years, we had depreciated out. Trying to think, what was the real numbers on that? It was $1.9 million about. So there was $600 of value
still on the books, book value on the balance sheet said $2.5 million minus accumulated depreciation of $1.9 million. So the amount on the books that was remaining was $600,000. Well, when you sold it, when we sold it for $800,000, that $200,000 spread between what we said it was worth and what we actually sold it at ended up getting taxed, hit with at the marginal tax rate. So that's why the after-tax salvage value is what you have to look at, not the pre-tax, not just how much did we sell it at. It's how much we sell it at minus the tax we had to deal with on the overhang. Okay, that, yeah, we on that. There, so moving on, though, talking about the salvage value, and I'll say this one more time. Your salvage value could be positive, it could be negative. One way, if it's positive, you just sold it, you made some money, you paid your tax if there was an excess of market price over book, fine. However, a lot of times it's going to be something other than that. You're going to end up spending more than you pull in closing down a project. The spending can be for things like hauling away equipment. Remediation is a nightmare at the end of a project, environmental remediation for some projects. Then you might have to lay off workers and pay unemployment to them and stuff like that. It can be negative or it can be positive. Now, one smart thing, as I've said, is sometimes the smartest thing is to just give away equipment as a charitable donation. That way, you get to write a big charitable thing on your income statement, and everyone thinks you're a very giving kind of corporation and all that. And what you're really doing is just getting rid of your problem. You're dumping your problem off on someone else. Now, if they're smart, they're going to figure out, okay, we don't want this, you fools. This is trouble. There was a story about a college. It's been some years back, that had an old lab, a chemistry lab, just off campus. And what they did was they magnanimously donated this building and all of its laboratory equipment to a local high school. That was an underprivileged school. They didn't get a lot. And so they were just like, oh my God, OMG, we've got a this lab. Wow. And of course, it was only over time that they realized, okay, we've got to modernize this. This is a dangerous place. You know, we don't like our kids, but we don't want them being killed in here. Then they, of course, had to face the fact that the building had asbestos coming out of a few places that had to be remediated by state and federal standards. And so it wasn't the gift that it originally appeared, but at the same time, the company got it off their books. One last thing about this, and I hope that you'll remember this someday when you're in doing these kinds of things. You don't do your salvage, your close down plan at the end. That should be at the beginning. For one thing, it's at the beginning that you're going to have to figure out that number there at the end, the salvage value. For another thing, closing down a project can be a huge project of its own. The more you have mapped it out at the beginning, that includes blueprints, engineering specs, that includes environmental remediation on the way through the project, the more you do that, the easier and cheaper it's going to be at the end. It's still going to have a cost to it probably, but it's going to be a lot better. You may, well, I don't know if you will, but you might be in a company about 2 years in and they'll say, all right, you're on this team that's going to deal with closing down a project. I guarantee you, you will bless the original planners of the project if they have the whole close down laid out for you in writing. You're going to curse them if they didn't even bother to think about it. Many are the stories of companies that produced toxic waste. And as they produced it, they would just dig pits and throw it in there. And then at the end, when the whole factory closed down, the project shut down, you had an environmental remediation nightmare from hell with 6 to 7 figures on it to deal with it. Famous story of a company, every year, it was like every month, they would just haul the toxic waste out. They had this huge, huge field behind the factory. They would literally just take a backhoe out there, dig a hole in the ground, and then haul the barrels of the crap, the dangerous crap out there and dump them in. And then cover it over, and the next time they needed it, they just send a backhoe out there to dig another hole and pour it in there. Well, then, of course, they were wondering why the frogs had 8 legs, and they said, hi. But at the end, when they closed it down, well, that's when the EPA came in, and they said, bad. And it cost them over $18 million to remediate on a project where they had projected a salvage value of positive about $1 million. So there you have it. Plan at the beginning for what happens at the end. In other words, so, sir, have you planned for your funeral yet? You should. You do know that your corpse is toxic waste. Environmental remediation? I think so. Plan now. Then your kids and your grandkids won't be saying, that stupid old fart, he just didn't plan, and now we've got to environmentally remediate where we poured him into the ground. Or if you're like me, cremated, and they toss you into the air and see where it takes me. It'll probably take me to hell anyway. But anyway. So there you go. Keep this in mind. Even if you run your own business or if you are a part of another business, close the project down at the beginning. Now, there will always be unforeseens, environmental regulation changes, changes in other laws, employee compensation, whatever, change in the market condition for the value of salvaged, of the value of the used goods. But for heaven's sakes, give it your best shot at the beginning, because that's not only going to give you better estimates of the net present value of the future expected cash flows when you're deciding whether or not to take on the project, but it's also going to make it a lot easier for the company to deal with it and its future employees when you do shut down, because they'll have a roadmap to finishing it up. Imagine for a second, if you will, sir, you're an Egyptian pharaoh, okay? And these guys built your pyramid. They've built your pyramid, okay? So now they are building it around your dead now, and they want to send you off to, you know, your Egyptian pharaoh heaven. Now, wouldn't it be nice if they had made a plan to make some tunnels so that they could leave after they put you in there? Wouldn't it... You would think they were pretty stupid if they walled up all the places that they went into, that they had gone into to put you in the center of the pyramid. Could you imagine that? You look at your, I'm looking at my fellow war. You morons! You just locked us in here with that decaying corpse. Well, maybe we'll go where he does. Yeah, and we'll be a slave forever. No, I don't think so. And so you get out your power drill and you drill your way out. Which requires a very new technology for those ancient Egyptians. Expensive? Yes. But necessary? I don't want to be in there and die with that guy. Where was I? Okay, so salvage value. I've got all that done. And so, the end of the story is rather straightforward. You do all the numbers right. Now, one thing. The actual getting to that EBIT line, you can do it really in a really complicated way, or you can be pretty darn loose in it. For at least some of the numbers going down, your cost of goods sold, your revenues, cost of goods sold, and your selling, general, and administrative expenses, the easy way, which I certainly would not encourage you to do, even though that's the way I do it, is to look at the past ratios of these different costs to the revenue. You project your revenue, and then you say, okay, I know that my cost of goods sold is about 34% of revenues. So I take each of the projected revenues, take 34% of it, and that gives me my cost of goods sold. I know that we've been having about 15% of revenues is what our selling, general, and administrative expenses is. So I take the projections for the revenues, and I take that percentage, and I put that for the SG&As going down the line projecting. Is that good to do it that way? No. What you probably would want to do, if you're going to do it that way, at least tweak the numbers. Yeah, our cost of goods sold seems to be pretty stable at 34%. Is it of revenue? Okay. Can we do better than that in the next years? Maybe can we bring it down to 32%, 31%? And then you have some of your market analysts say, you were going to be lucky if we can hold it at 34%. You might want to tweak that up to 35, 36% as some of our suppliers begin to bleed through their extra costs to us. Okay, fine. That's part of the game. Try to start with a baseline percentage and then adjust it. Okay, selling, general, and administrative expenses have been 15%. Okay, we are going to get rid of a bunch of employees. We're going to fire them. We're just going to get them out. So that should bring down our SG&A to about, if we do like 1,200 employees, get them out of our payroll, that should bring our SG&A down from 15% down to 12%. So you have those numbers. Essentially, you're starting with a base percentage of revenue, and then you're tweaking it based upon serious intentions to control costs or serious expectations that some of your costs are going to go up. That's just how you do it. Now, you can do it in a much more complicated way, taking each line, cost of goods sold, okay, we've got this supplier, add them up, and our sales, general, and administrative expenses, this is how much we have in hourly payrolls, how much we have in salaried payrolls, this is how much we pay for marketing, and each line you project on its own. That is a lot like work, but it's detailed and it gets you better numbers. But how much better? Honestly, from what I've seen, the more the percentage with adjustments approach doesn't get you much, isn't much worse than doing it in an extraordinarily painfully detailed way. But one way or another, you get to that NOPAT, you get to your free cash flow, and then you're essentially, you take the net present value of the future expected cash flows, and you're done. Now, I'm going to show you on Thursday one fairly complete example, and I'm going to give you some of the numbers along the way and the thinking for another example. In one case, a very large consumer foods company was considering a project to take on a gluten-free pastry, as a breakfast pastry. Now, traditionally, gluten-free has meant joy-free. Gluten-free has meant sad. They wanted, as a matter of fact, some companies, even though they make their product is gluten-free, they won't put it on the package or they'll hide it because it is a negative in marketing. A good example of that is Cheetos. If you look on the package very carefully, on the back, down at the bottom, in small print, it says gluten-free. In other words, who doesn't eat Cheetos until you've got a pack of that Cheetos stuff stuck in your gums and your like this? Of course we do. We like them. If it said gluten-free on the front, they might hurt their sales. So this company thought, okay, we're going to put the muscle of our name into this, and we're also going to spend the money to make it actually taste great. And so they were trying to avoid the adverse reaction. The problem was that there was still going to be some cannibalization. If this pastry really was tasty and it was made by a reputable company, well, that company's other breakfast pastries that are not gluten-free, they might suffer because people would say, that tastes good, it's gluten-free, and I guess gluten-free is healthier. And so they could actually face a little bit of a cannibalistic effect on their other products from making this one. There, it's kind of a nice example. And then there's one that I'll show you. That was a very new product. It had a very short life, I think only 4 years. And it had to do with, this was another very reputable, well-known company. And one of its first forays into consumer products. It had always been a B2B, business-to-business company. And it stepped into the world of routers, those things that move your internet stuff around. But these weren't just any routers. This was at the beginning of the Internet of Things, which is not the internet that you know. Now, when when you, sir, go to the internet, you surf for lolcats, you go on Tinder, you might do a little bit of TikTok dance, you know. I saw yours. It was good. I mean, maybe a little risque, but, you know, that was just when you were wearing that weird hat. Okay, now, shut up. The thing, though, is that it was dawning maybe about 10 years ago, the Internet of Things, appliances that talk to each other, that talk to their mothership, that talk to other companies, a coffee pot that talks to its manufacturer, a refrigerator that will tell your favorite grocery store when you're running low on your food. Now, isn't that weird? Can you imagine that it will come very soon that you won't know it, but you're low on Greek low-fat Chobani peach yogurt, and you will say, gee, I'm low on Chobani low-fat Greek peach yogurt, and then there will be a ring of the doorbell, ding dong, and then you open it, yes, and there will be a drone standing there with a bag of Chobani Greek low-fat peach yogurt. It talked to the store, and you open the door, and it comes in, and it turns in like one of those mech warriors, and the robot, and it opens and puts your Chobani low-fat Greek peach yogurt in the refrigerator for you, bids you a good day, and then leaves and turns back into a drone and goes away. That's the Internet of Things. Your car talks to other places. It's not conspiracy theory. Don't get paranoid. It's too late to be paranoid. It will tell the government if you have an accident, they will just plug in and they'll see what really happened as opposed to what you said happened by the dynamics of the spin of your car as it flipped around and went over the railing and landed on a truck and went down to St. Louis. The Internet of Things is here. And they were at the forefront. They said, okay, we want to build routers that actually service the Internet of Things. And so it was obviously going to be a short-term project because the technology was going to move very quickly, but they knew that there was a window, an opening, and so they did the free cash flow. They literally did the free cash flow analysis for this relatively short, it was 4 or 5 years, I can't remember which it was, but I'll show it to you. And just the numbers, it's not complicated. It's just like sort of Excel spreadsheets. But at the end, they said this has a positive net present value of future expected cash flows. They went with it. Sure enough, it was a success. They closed it down cleanly. They did the environmental remediation of the lab where they did the quality assurance and testing of the units that they were buying wholesale from China. And they moved forward with new projects. So the next one they did was a replacement and a new project, at the same time for their original Internet of Things routers. Well, I'll show you that on Thursday. It won't take too long, and I'll give you a quiz so that you go home happy and ready for Thanksgiving. But for tonight, that's all I have for you. I thank you.